welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 161. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm looking at a couple of slightly pastiche-like Sherlock Holmes films. The first one is from 1970, was directed by the late, great Billy Wilder, and that is The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. And then we're moving on to 1976 for an even stranger iteration of the Holmes canon, and that is The 7% Solution. Now, the first one stars Robert Stevens and Colin Blakely as Holmes and Watson. The second one stars Nicole Williamson and Robert Duvall as Holmes and Watson. They're both really interesting. They're both totally different looks at Sherlock Holmes from people who really do like the Sherlock Holmes stories, and they're a little bit of fun, so sit back, relax, I'll get the credits out of the way, and then we'll start the show. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of classic movie appreciation. There are only two rules to the podcast. The first one is that I have to like the film, or it's been suggested by a Patreon subscriber. The other rule is that it has to be at least 20 years old. So none of this new stuff, it's all old, it's all good. So if you want to contact me, you can email at cultguru@gmail.com, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com, or else you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can also go to paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. Now, there occasionally are adult themes and adult language used in this podcast. Just be aware of that as well. You can also leave reviews on iTunes, so if you're so inclined, please do so. It would help the podcast out a lot. So sit back, relax now, and we'll get on with the show. And thank you for listening. Hey, how's everybody going? We're getting ready here, as I said, in the last Martian Drive-In, which I'm releasing the same day I release this one. We're getting ready to go to Continuum, the science fiction convention in Melbourne, in the long weekend at the beginning of June. Then we're going to fly off to Sydney and Perth. So if anybody's in Perth and wants to do a catch-up, we can do coffee at a cafe or something like that, if you like, and we'd be happy to kind of catch up and shoot the shit and have a bit of fun there. So it's going to be about 3 weeks all up. And we need the break, to be honest with you. We really need the break, and we've now got the opportunity to do that, and we're looking forward to doing it. So, it's going to be a groovy thing. I really do want to revisit Perth. I haven't been there for quite a long time. One of the things that we are doing is Travis Johnson, a movie buff of some renown in WA, is doing a 40th anniversary screening of Jaws at a nice little place called the Backlot near Leederville. So we've booked tickets to see that on the Saturday afternoon that we're in Perth, or one of the Saturday afternoons we're in Perth anyway. And so that's going to be a bit of a groovy thing too. I've seen the website for the Backlot, and it looks like a really lovely venue. It's got great big murals of classic film stuff. I'll paste a few things on Facebook once we go there, and we're really looking forward to that as well. So there are things going nicely at the moment. It's not just run-of-the-mill. We've actually got some stuff, some travel going on, and I haven't been on a plane for a few years for some reason. With various health issues and things like that, we really haven't done much plane travel. Done a little bit of car travel, but not much plane travel over the last number of years. So that's going to be, again, a challenge. You know, you've got to take your shoes off. You've got to make sure you don't carry any nuclear weapons or knives onto aeroplanes, all that kind of stuff. So I'm sure we'll be okay with it anyway. So, hope everybody else is doing okay. Everybody's shitting themselves crazy about Mad Max Fury Road. I haven't seen it yet. I will see it, but I haven't seen it yet. Just with everything else going on and the kind of preparations for going away, really haven't had time to do it. And one of the other things I've got to do, of course, is get a couple of extra podcasts up my belt, so I can't leave you guys hanging for some content. So I'm not sure whether I'm going to actually fill them with movies or whether we're going to do a couple of music episodes, but one way or the other, there will be Paleo Cinemas and Martian Drive-In podcasts in the hiatus. I'd hate to leave you guys. I think I've missed one in 7 years with Paleo Cinema podcast, nearly 8 years, in fact, which is kind of crazy, but that's how it goes. And I actually did check, and if you on archive.org, there's a little podcast Sal and I did 10 years ago this November. So I've been doing this thing for just about a decade, and you really would think I'd be doing it better than I am, but that's how it goes. You put your money in and it takes your chances, and if you don't put money in, please put money in via the Patreon campaign, and then you can feel justified at ranting at me because you're paying for this. Anyway, the two Sherlock Holmes movies I'm looking forward to doing, they're really a lot of fun. I was kind of dithering about what I would do. I do have a lot of people who are donating to the Patreon campaign and suggesting movies for Martian Drive-In podcast, but less so for Paleo Cinema. So if you want to chuck a couple of bucks in and suggest a movie for Paleo Cinema podcast, that would be fine, as long as it's not The Nun Story or The Singing Nun or Sound of Music or anything with like nuns in it. I'm not doing any nun erotica, nun sploitation. I'm not doing any nun sploitation either. I just don't like the nun thing. But anyway, I'm going to take a... No, actually, I won't take a break. What I will do is tell you what I have been watching since last I strapped on this headset microphone. I'm up to 156 movies this year. I know that's not as much as some other people have done, but I don't really want to be a size queen about this kind of thing. If you want to, blame the Xbox, because I've been playing Diablo 3 again and played it all the way through to the end one more once. But yeah, there hasn't been a lot since the last Martian Drive-In, because I only just did the Martian Drive-In podcast. But there are a couple of things, one of which is I kind of got stuck re-watching the Tommy Lee Jones disaster film from 1997, Volcano. It's about a volcano in Los Angeles, and it's got lots of ash falling on people and heroic events with lava and all that kind of thing. It's just one of those kind of popcorny movies, and there's a couple of nice little set pieces. The guy on the train rescuing the other person as the lava goes through the train tunnel is kind of cool. There are just a couple of bits and pieces there that I really do like, and they're a bit of fun. But Tommy Lee Jones and Anne Heche pretty much have the kind of chemistry of a couple of pet rocks. It really doesn't work very well, but nonetheless it's an interesting film, and the effects for the time were very, very good. The only other two things I've watched, and again they're very different films as well, was Love Has Many Faces, starring Lana Turner, Cliff Robertson and Hugh O'Brien. It's about a rich lady who's married to an ex beach boy in Acapulco, and Hugh O'Brien plays another beach boy in Acapulco. Hugh O'Brien looked really good for 40. He was really well fit for a 40-year-old guy at the time. Spends a lot of the movie with his shirt off and a shark tooth necklace on, wearing swimming trunks and things like that. There are a couple of other nice little bits in it. It's basically a chick film. It's a women's film. Lana Turner has about 87 costume changes in the movie, and her costumes by Edith Head ended up costing $1 million. I know she, you know, $1 million worth of costumes in 1965. And yeah, it's about kind of gigolos and rich women and bullfighting and all sorts of weird stuff like that. It's got Ruth Roman in a very nice little role. She's got some scenes with Hugh O'Brien which are very good. They're much better than the rest of the movie, to be honest. And she, playing a kind of woman in her 40s, which she was, who hires Hugh O'Brien to be her companion, she has some really kind of worldly and smart things, and she's having a great time with it, and brings about 50, 60 times the charisma that Lana Turner brought to her role as Kit, the rich, indolent woman married to a dissatisfied Cliff Robertson. Stephanie Powers is in there as the female ingenue in there. And, yeah, it's one of the few movies that you can really say you will see Lana Turner get gored by a bull. She does get gored by a bull in that movie. I think what I should do is try to do the movie for the podcast, just to do it justice, and maybe get somebody like Dr. Zom on board, because Zom and I, way back when, did Valley of the Dolls and had a lot of fun with that. So I think our métier together is going to be chick flicks from the 1960s, so maybe we need to do that. I think we, what do we do, Valley of the Dolls and The Pleasure Seekers with Anne Margaret in it. So I think Love Has Many Faces may be a movie that he and I could do together. I will put it out there and see what comes of it. Now, the other movie I did was from 1970 and was directed by Melvin Van Peebles. And it is Watermelon Man, starring Godfrey Cambridge and Estelle Parsons. It's about a white, racist, sexist, moron insurance salesman played by Godfrey Cambridge as a white man. He's in whiteface. Who wakes up one morning and finds that he's become a black man. And things flow along from there. You've got to remember this is during the civil rights era of the late 1960s and 1970. It stars and was directed by black gentlemen. And it's a lot of fun. I really should add that to the podcast list as well. Watermelon Man, the politics of it are dated, I'll be honest. But Godfrey Cambridge does have a lot of fun with the role. And it's the movie. This movie is famous for one particular reason. And that is, this is the movie that gave Melvin Van Peebles the studio clout to make Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. He got the money together for that movie based on Watermelon Man. Now, Watermelon Man was going to be the first of three movies he did for Columbia, but Melvin Van Peebles wanted to go his own way and ended up making Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song one of the seminal blaxploitation movies instead. But seeing Watermelon Man was a lot of fun. I had seen it in an Encore cinema way back very early in the 1970s when I was sneaking out and about at night time as a teenager. And revisiting it, yes, yeah, dated, and yes, there's some silly stuff there, but it's still got some punch to it, and it shows that the racism of the 1960s slash up to 1970 was much more overt than the crypto-racism we see in a lot of places now, particularly in political endeavours and in social media. You see a lot of racism and sexism and ageism and all sorts of other things hidden behind a facade of reasonability. But this one is right out there, and it's a lot of fun. Godfrey Cambridge is good as the asshole, and his epiphanies along the way as he learns to live life as a black man are quite to the point and interesting. There's also a cameo in the movie by Mantan Morlan, who people who know their cinema know was one of those guys like, and you know, one of those black guys who played kind of bug-eyed black guys in movies, along with people like Stephen Fetchett, whose real name was Lincoln Perry. And I've actually got a biography of Stephen Fetchett, which I picked up at a book fair recently. It's called Stephen Fetchett, The Life and Times of Lincoln Perry by Mel Watkins. And I really have to read this book because I've been looking at it on the shelf for a while. And just getting that other view of Hollywood history is going to be an interesting experience for me. But apart from those movies, I haven't watched a hell of a lot. I've been watching a lot of TV. There's a lot of superhero TV shows on at the moment, and I've been glutting myself with those. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about the first of the two movies, which I have on a lovely Blu-ray edition from the US, paid for by the Patreon campaign, by the way. And that is The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, directed by Billy Wilder, written by Billy Wilder and I.A.L. Diamond, his writing partner, starring Robert Stevens as Sherlock Holmes. Mycroft Holmes is played by Christopher Lee, no less, and Colin Blakely playing Dr. Watson.
Billy Wilder, the man who gave you The Apartment and Some Like It Hot, now reveals The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. Dr. Watson in his lifetime recorded some 60 cases demonstrating the singular gift of his friend Sherlock Holmes. But there were other adventures, which for reasons of discretion were withheld from the public. Adventures which involved matters of a delicate and sometimes scandalous nature. The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes was anything but elementary.
My dear Sherlock, there are certain affairs that do not come within the province of the private detective.
The public has a right to know these things.
Sherlock Holmes was a man of curious habits and eccentric tastes.
Aren't you ashamed of yourself?
Thoroughly. But this will take care of it.
And not always what he seemed to be.
You have described me as 6'4", whereas I am barely 6'1".
Mother says you are shorter than she thought.
Oh, I didn't mean to be.
I hope I'm not being presumptuous, but
But there have been women in your life.
I thought I would never find you. It's been such a long time.
I found her body quite rewarding, especially the palm of her right hand.
Midgets.
What is it indeed that feeds on canary birds and sulfuric acid and has an engine for a heart? Open that door.
Sherlock, when I said drop this case, it was not merely a suggestion, it was an order.
By whose authority?
By the authority of Her Majesty's government.
Holmes, you better take this with you.
Your client isn't Madame Valador. It's the Imperial German government.
Holmes, I saw it. The monster.
It's getting closer and closer.
It took a genius to cover up Sherlock Holmes' vices, blunders, and bizarre tastes. Sherlock Holmes was a genius. The private life of Sherlock Holmes was anything but elementary.
The 1970 film The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes was the fifth last movie directed by Billy Wilder. He was 68 at the time. He'd been making movies since his mid-20s and really had a little bit of trouble in the late 60s getting projects together. If you have a look at his filmography, he had some real wins at the beginning of the 1960s. There was The Apartment and Irma Douce, Kiss Me Stupid, which I'm really going to have to do for a future Paleo Cinema, The Fortune Cookie, and then there's a four-year gap between The Fortune Cookie and The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. Back in 1957, when Wilder was in London to do the external shots for Witness for the Prosecution, he had the idea of doing a Sherlock Holmes musical. Big musicals were big at the time, things like My Fair Lady, Brigadoon, and stuff like that. So he and his writing pal, I.A.L. Diamond, Izzy Diamond, decided they were going to make a musical of Sherlock Holmes, which, you know, what seemed like a good idea at the time. This never came to pass. They talked to Lerner and Lowe and a bunch of other people, but nothing ever came to pass with it. But they got the rights, and they kept the rights. And this eventually became the project that was The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. There are a couple of things that Wilder said about The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes which were kind of interesting. In retrospect, he said after he'd made the film, and it was a bit of a financial fizzle, it cost $10 million to make and made about $1.5 million. One of the things he said he should have done was gone bolder with it. He had this idea that Sherlock Holmes was actually gay. And the reason he took cocaine was to kind of hide the shame of that and because of the tensions caused by being homosexual. This, of course, would have blown Sherlock Holmes way out of the water for everybody. And I'm not sure that the estate would have agreed to it. But it's an interesting way of looking at it. And it may have taken the movie in a different direction than ultimately it did, where Holmes is seen as a misogynist for a reason by being betrayed by a woman. Billy Wilder, like a lot of Germans, really liked Sherlock Holmes as a character. He'd read the stories as a boy. He and his writing partner, I.A.L. Diamond, decided to put together this kind of slightly unusual twist on the tale. Before this, most Sherlock Holmes adaptations were pretty straightforward things. They did have certain changes made about them. Of course, the most famous series of Sherlock Holmes movies being the ones that Universal did with Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce in them, which went for well over a decade. But Wilder wanted to do things a little differently, and he wanted to kind of dig into the character a little more and understand the character a little more and address a couple of the elephants in the room regarding the private life of Sherlock Holmes. As a part of this, changing the story a bit, originally Sherlock Holmes was going to be played in this movie by Peter O'Toole, with Dr. Watson being played by Peter Sellers. Now, while I could see Peter O'Toole doing Sherlock Holmes and doing a good job of it, I'm not sure I could see Peter Sellers playing a secondary role. This was at a time when Sellers was doing starring roles, and very much in this film, Dr. Watson is a secondary character. So you couldn't really see Peter Sellers doing that. And Peter Sellers' tendency to mug and to draw attention to himself really would not have done the movie any good at all. Though Peter O'Toole and Peter Sellers had worked before in a couple of other movies. What's New Pussycat and a little bit in Casino Royale, the 1966 silly version of the story. Anyway, Billy Wilder decided to go in another direction, and he cast a well-known stage actor from the UK, Robert Stevens, to play Sherlock Holmes. Stevens had been with the Royal Shakespeare Company for a long time and left it in 1970. He did have alcohol problems, which plagued him for a lot of his career. His third wife, he married four times. His third wife was Maggie Smith, with whom he starred in The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie. And his fourth wife was Patricia Quinn, who played Columbia in Rocky Horror Picture Show. And Stevens has appeared in two movies that have already been spoken about on Paleo Cinema Podcast, an inevitable occurrence. And they are The Asphyx, which is a nice little British, almost steampunky horror film from the early 70s, and The Shout, starring Alan Bates and John Hurt. He's also the father of Toby Stevens, who played the main villain in Die Another Day, the James Bond film starring Pierce Brosnan. But we'll leave aside his lineage for now. Then you've got Colin Blakely playing Dr. Watson, and he does a pretty okay job of it. He can do the comedy parts, and there are some funny bits in this film as well as the serious parts. And he's got a kind of tough little rugby player look about him, which kind of works well for Dr. Watson, who is nothing like the characterization we had from Nigel Bruce in the 1930s and 1940s. But Colin Blakely does a good job there. The supporting cast is interesting. Originally, Sherlock's brother Mycroft was going to be played by George Sanders, who left because of ill health. And he was replaced by Christopher Lee, who of course had been in the Hounds of the Baskervilles and knew the Sherlock Holmes canon quite well. The most interesting thing about Mycroft Holmes being played by Christopher Lee is it's one of the very few Christopher Lee roles where he has his natural hairline, i.e. bald. And I think that works. I think Christopher Lee has a good shaped head. And all of the wigs he wore in subsequent films really don't do honour to the fact that he had a really kind of nice looking dome. He's got a scalp that is probably better than Patrick Stewart's. But leaving that aside, Christopher Lee in this is pretty good. Though I do kind of admit I do like the wig he wore in The Wicker Man. That was a nice little rug, that one. It really worked well. The story of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, I probably should get into the plot of the thing, is that Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson get involved with the plight of a lady in distress, Gabrielle Valadon, played by Genevieve Page, who is found amnesiac and whose husband is a mining engineer who's gone missing. The chase leads them to Loch Ness, which is kind of cool, and Castle Urquhart, which is on the shore of Loch Ness. And I've actually seen Castle Urquhart. And the first thing I thought about when I saw Castle Urquhart was Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. And secret doings by the British government and, of course, the German imperial government at the time regarding secret weapons. I won't go too much into what the secret weapons are, but there are secret weapons there, and they are kind of interesting, and we have a weird silliness about them involving midgets and poison gases and the Loch Ness monster. But leaving that aside, the other people supporting cast is pretty cool. There's Clive Revel playing Rogozhin, who's a Russian guy who's involved with the Russian government and with the Ballet Russe. Madame Petrova, one of the prima ballerinas of the Ballet Russe, wants to have a child by Sherlock Holmes. And this then brings up the elephant in the room of Sherlock Holmes' private life and his disdain for women. And this is where Billy Wilder diverts from the idea that Sherlock Holmes was actually gay. He does tell the Russian guy played by Clive Revel, that he and Dr. Watson are very happy together. This, of course, outrages the Victorian propriety of Dr. Watson, but the way it's handled by Billy Wilder and I.L. Diamond is very kind of European and sophisticated. As I've said before in the podcast about Billy Wilder, he grew up at a time in Germany where kind of alternative sexualities and polymorphous perversity was accepted and okay. He was a journalist and writer in Weimar Germany when Berlin was at its most decadent. And they say that one quarter of the people in Berlin at the time were involved in the sex trade in some ways. It was an immense, crazy little period in Germany where gay and lesbianism was out in the open. There were sex shows in nightclubs. There was all sorts of theatre and prostitution and orgies and all sorts of stuff. They kind of went a little bit crazy at the time from the sexual point of view. And Billy Wilder, being a nice little Austrian boy, wrote a little bit about that. So he was kind of comfortable with alternative sexualities from a fairly early adult age. And so his even-handedness in handling the fact that a number of ballet dancers, for instance, are gay, was done in a quite sophisticated manner. And the humour that comes from it is, A, the way Robert Stevens puts it across to tell Clive Revel that he and Dr. Watson are happy together, and Colin Blakely's outrage. So the humour in it isn't the fact that there are gay people in the world, but the humour in it is of people's reaction to there being gay people in the world. And that is an important difference. There are any number of movies of the time which mocked and derided gay, lesbian, transgender, whatever kind of people. But this isn't one of them, and this isn't where Billy Wilder was coming from. He was very comfortable with the sexuality of other people, which is kind of nice to see, and didn't happen that much in cinema at the time. But you want to mention the music, too. The music is by Miklos Rocha, who was coming near the end of his career, and it's a very traditional kind of Hollywood-y soundtrack, heavy on the strings, of course, with Sherlock Holmes being a well-known violin player. But it works in context to give us that kind of Victorian era nostalgic mood, though it doesn't play as well to 21st century ears as a more contemporary soundtrack might. It really does seem to be music for a movie made 20 years before this one, at least. But having said that, it's nice in there. The set design and the costume design is fantastic in this film. They did do a large backlot set of Baker Street in London, where Sherlock Holmes lived, 21B Baker Street. Where I've been to, by the way, we did do a Sherlock Holmes homage in London once. This movie, in a sense, is one of those ones where studios interfered a lot. Originally, it was going to be a bit of a tentpole movie. Remember in the 1960s how they had longish movies where there'd be an intermission in the middle where they'd play the overture for the movie soundtrack, and then you come into the second part of the film and watch the rest of the story after having a break? It usually happened with films around about 3 hours long. This movie was intended to do that. In fact, there are some missing scenes which are included on the Blu-ray as extras, some of it as script and some of it as stills and audio taken from the missing scenes. There are two crimes that Sherlock Holmes solves in the intended version of this film, one of which involves a man dead in a room with all the furniture stuck to the ceiling, and another one which is called The Case of the Naked Honeymooners, which we only ever see as a script in the extras on the Blu-ray of The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes. But ultimately, what happened was, after he made the film, Wilder went to Paris for a time. And while he was in Paris, the studio recut the film, taking out the scenes and losing the footage, of course, for these extra scenes. So the movie was a lot shorter. The studio wanted a shorter film, in essence, and didn't tell Wilder. He was very pissed off about it because he considered it among his best works. And a lot of Sherlock Holmes fans consider it amongst the best Holmes adaptations as well. It is very well considered for a lot of reasons. It addresses a lot of the issues people have with Sherlock Holmes, the accusations of misogyny and things like that, and shows him to be a man of passion without going into too many details and too many spoilers. He really does have a sense of the romantic, and the movie does portray a certain personal tragedy, as indeed does The 7% Solution, the second of the two movies that I'm going to talk about here. And I think that Robert Stevens does have the skill and does go to a place of vulnerability for Sherlock Holmes as well, even though he does do the mandatory smarty pants scenes where Sherlock Holmes looks at a person and tells you a lot about their history based on his super keen sense of observation. You've always got to have that kind of stunt scene in a Sherlock Holmes movie, and he doesn't disappoint in that. But just to wrap up for The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, it's one of the better Sherlock Holmes films out there. Really does enlarge the Sherlock Holmes universe in some ways and shows that you can have alternate readings of Sherlock Holmes. It would have been nice had he gone bolder, as he said, and confirmed that Sherlock Holmes was gay, even though that would have been controversial then. Indeed, it would be controversial now were it the case. I think that it would have changed the course of Sherlock Holmes movies in an interesting way. Nonetheless, the movie is beautiful to look at. It has a lot of fun scenes. It has a Loch Ness monster. They actually built a Loch Ness monster in Loch Ness, but the monster they built sank, and so they had to do a lot of studio shots to take up the slack as far as the Loch Ness monster was concerned. And the story goes that Billy Wilder was unhappy that the Loch Ness monster they had sank. But he wasn't unhappy for himself. He was unhappy for the poor guy who built the Loch Ness monster. And when the prop they had for the Loch Ness monster sank, Billy Wilder just walked over to the guy who'd built it and put his arm around him to console him, which shows the kind of guy Wilder was. He was a very hard taskmaster in a lot of ways. He was very precise in what he wanted. He liked disciplined actors, but in this one, he was at play. It was a nice piece of work and had the other virtue of being very different from pretty much anything else Billy Wilder had done. So I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, I'm going to talk about the second of the movies for this time around, The 7% Solution, directed by Herbert Ross, script written by Nicholas Meyer, who also wrote and directed Star Trek II: The Search for Spock. And it's a kick-ass story and a lot of fun. And again, like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, it takes Sherlock Holmes in a different direction.
Shortly before the turn of the century, two of the great minds of all time met and began an adventure that history has yet to record. Sherlock Holmes and Sigmund Freud. Together they uncover tests their divine brilliance and threatens their very lives. Universal presents The 7% Solution, Nicholas Meyer's best-selling mystery from the personal memoirs of Dr. John H. Watson.
First, you must tell me how you guessed the details of my life with such uncanny accuracy.
I never guess. It is an appalling habit, destructive to the logical faculty.
This is wonderful.
Come on, please.
The 7% Solution, revealing for the first time the vile and destructive habit that almost destroyed the world's greatest detective.
Watson!
The true identity of Sherlock Holmes' arch-nemesis, Professor James Moriarty.
You startled me.
Come on, Watson!
And the extraordinary circumstances surrounding the hitherto unknown affair, known as the adventure of the 7% Solution.
That's right.
Nicole Williamson is Sherlock Holmes. Alan Arkin is Dr. Sigmund Freud. Robert Duvall is Dr. John H. Watson. Vanessa Redgrave is the lovely Lola Devereaux. Jeremy Kemp is the Baron von Leinsdorf. Joel Grey is the possibly fictitious Lowenstein.
Say yes!
And Sir Laurence Olivier is Professor Moriarty.
Persecuting me is the only way I can put it.
Persecuting you?
I see everything.
I am on the case, and you have placed me there. Now you must follow my instructions.
Sherlock Holmes' most baffling mystery. Sigmund Freud's most curious case. The year's most intriguing motion picture.
Where was this train originally heading?
Dresden, look. It is now the Orient Express.
There has been no explanation for the 7% solution until now.
Nicholas Meyer wrote three books in the Sherlock Holmes canon. The first one, of course, being The 7% Solution, which was made into a 1976 Universal film, but he did two others as well. The Canary Trainer, which is a novel set in and around the Paris Opera in the time of Sherlock Holmes, and includes an encounter with none other than the Phantom of the Opera, which is kind of cool, and that was written in 1993. And we also have The West End Horror, which was published in 1976. So that was the second one. The third one, of course, being The Canary Trainer, which is kind of cool. I've got a copy of The West End Horror, but I haven't had a chance to read it yet. But Nicholas Meyer's The 7% Solution has an unusual and interesting conceit. It addresses one of the issues that people have with Sherlock Holmes as a character, and that, of course, is his addiction to cocaine. And what Nicholas Meyer does in the book and subsequently in the movie is reverse engineer that to give it a reason and then also to give it a cure, which is more important. Now, I'm going to do some spoilers on this one. It's a 1976 movie, so if I do spoilers on this, too bad, so sad. I'm going to do spoilers on it because I think it's very important to the plot that I do that. The movie was written by Meyer and directed by Herbert Ross. Ross's career is kind of interesting because he started out doing plays and things like that. He was an actor in a couple of things like Macbeth in 1942. But he was a choreographer in The Young One's Son Summer Holiday by Cliff Richard. So he did a choreographer as well. But he started his film career with Goodbye, Mr. Chips, the remake of the Robert Donat movie that starred Peter O'Toole. He did The Owl and the Pussycat and Funny Lady with Barbara Streisand. Pennies from Heaven, the 1981 film, The Sunshine Boys. Footloose, Steel Magnolias, he directed that as well. He also did Undercover Blues, a very good movie with Alec Baldwin in it from 1993. My Blue Heaven, and some more ordinary stuff. He did California Suite, which is an interesting film I really should do for the podcast. And The Goodbye Girl with Richard Dreyfuss, which he did immediately after The 7% Solution. He also directed a movie I've already talked about on the podcast, come to think of it, The Last of Sheila, which was written by none other than Stephen Sondheim and Anthony Perkins. The Last of Sheila is a movie you should definitely see. It's a lot of fun. But anyway, that's Herbert Ross. Now, the choice of actors for playing Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson in this film is very interesting. For Dr. Watson, they chose Robert Duvall, who wasn't known for playing English ex-army surgeons. Of course, he started out playing Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird and Tom Hagen in The Godfather and then went on to a fine and illustrious career. But in this one, it's a bit different. His English accent isn't too bad. It's surprisingly good for an American actor. And his Watson is the tougher kind of Watson, a Watson more true to the novels than many of the others that have been in the Sherlock Holmes cinematic universe. And I kind of like him in this. I think it's a warmer role than we've seen from a lot of Robert Duvall's output. And the genuine sense of the deep friendship between the two men, which is portrayed both by Robert Duvall playing Dr. Watson and the choice of actor they had for Sherlock Holmes, who was a very kind of off-the-wall choice, Nicole Williamson. Now, Nicole Williamson's an actor I really like a lot. He did a number of things well. He was a jazz singer, amongst other things. He did a version of Darktown Strutters Ball at a gala for Richard Nixon, which was written about in a really good essay about Williamson by one of my favourite 20th century essayists, Kenneth Tynan. He had trouble with alcohol and he was a womaniser a bit, but there are a few movies in which Nicole Williamson was great. His Hamlet is very good. I've seen the filmed version of His Hamlet, and he is really good as Hamlet in that. And another movie that I really like, and I really should do for future podcasts, though I'm on a bit of a hiatus on doing Michael Caine movies. and that is the Wilby Conspiracy, which had Sidney Poitier, Michael Caine, and Nicole Williamson playing a South African secret policeman, and he's very good in that, and really nasty as well. He is he was very, very good at being evil. But here's Sherlock Holmes in this movie. He starts out incredibly vulnerable. He's at his wit's end. His cocaine addiction has overtaken him. He has paranoid delusions about Professor Moriarty. And one of the conceits that Nicholas Meyer has in this particular movie is that Professor Moriarty, who was the mathematics tutor for both Sherlock and Mycroft Holmes, is not the mastermind of crime. That part of Professor Moriarty, as we know him from movies and other things, is actually a delusion caused by Sherlock Holmes' addiction to a 7% solution of cocaine injected. Now, that's kind of a cool conceit, and this is where Nicholas Meyer really shines. I was going to say Nicholas Meyer's script really shines. And that is the fact that to cure Sherlock Holmes of the addiction and to kind of help him regain his senses and sensibilities, boom tish, they trick, with the assistance of Mycroft Holmes, who's smarter than his brother, by the way, played in this case by Charles Gray, who people remember played in two James Bond films and also was the narrator in the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Charles Gray playing Mycroft helps Dr. Watson can basically conjure up a conspiracy which will lead Sherlock Holmes to Vienna so that his cocaine addiction can be assisted by none other than Sigmund Freud, played in this case quite charmingly by Alan Arkin in a beard. So you can see right from the start, this is not your Basil Rathbone kind of Sherlock Holmes movie. It's very, very different from that. And it seems, because of that, to be a lot more grounded than a normal Sherlock Holmes film would be. And that is one of the charms and the virtues of it. And also, Nicole Williamson's acting in this is superb. He said he wasn't familiar with the Sherlock Holmes novels when he did the role. And whether that's true or not, some actors say those kind of things and they're not true. But whether it's true or not, he really does an unusual job of playing Sherlock Holmes. He's brittle and fast-speaking and brilliant and paranoid and has a real sense of danger. You get the sense while he is in the cocaine binge that this guy is a loose cannon and very, very dangerous. And very dishonest, and he's got the misogyny that very often Sherlock Holmes has been accused of, but there's actually a reason for it. Now, I'm not going to give that part as a spoiler. The connection between Professor Moriarty, the history with the Holmes brothers, and the reason for Sherlock Holmes' suspicion of women. If you haven't seen the movie, see it. I'll leave that one as a spoiler-free zone. But it is very interesting and quite well grounded and gives a new dimension to Sherlock Holmes as a character as well. Now, while Sherlock Holmes is in Vienna, taking the cure through hypnosis partly and through withdrawal with the assistance of Sigmund Freud, a new plot line develops in which a former patient of Sigmund Freud's, a lady actress called Lola Devereaux, played by Vanessa Redgrave. Very nicely, too. I like Vanessa Redgrave in this role. I've got a crush on Vanessa Redgrave and probably always will have. But in this one, she does play things very well. It's not one of her more over-the-top roles, but I think she is very charming in it and very beautiful and does a nice job of playing a woman who, because of her beauty, has in some ways been successful as an actress, but has also paid a high price for it as well, in a male-oriented 19th century society. So Lola Devereaux comes back into things. She's been kidnapped and re-addicted to drugs. and Sherlock Holmes using his deductive powers helps Sigmund Freud track down who has done this to Lola Devereaux, and the plot thickens and the game is afoot. So that's basically as far as I'm going to go on the plot of this movie. We deal with Professor Moriarty quite quickly earlier on in the film, except for a coda where an explanation is given. And Professor Moriarty's played in a kind of twitchy, neurotic, and troubled version by none other than Sir Laurence Olivier, Lord Olivier. And as Professor Moriarty, he is quite good. It's one of those smaller character roles that he did at the time. It's nowhere near like a movie he did in around the same time. Of course, being Marathon Man, he's nothing like the Vice Angel, the White Angel in the Marathon Man. And he does get to play his neurotic older guy thing quite well. It's a kind of role that could have been done by a number of different actors, but the fact that they did get Laurence Olivier to do it just gives a little prestige to the production in a nice way, and plays against our expectations when he says he is Professor Moriarty, which is kind of cool because we're used to having that flamboyance with Moriarty, as in a number of other iterations, including the TV Sherlock and other things, where Professor Moriarty is one of those roles that you can play over the top as an actor and really have some fun with. And he's got to be at least as interesting as Sherlock Holmes is to make that work. But in this way, they undercut that to make Moriarty a nervous school teacher with a troubled past. And that is, I kind of like that. Again, like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, the mise-en-scene is very good. The sense of the 19th century of Vienna in particular, but also of London, Holmes's London, is well evoked. The burgeoning respect between Sherlock Holmes and Lola Devereaux is handled very, very well. And I like that little bit at the end on the boat, which I'm not going to tell you about, but I do like that, this sense of seeing Sherlock Holmes in a totally different light. Now, but for me, it all comes back to Nicole Williamson playing as Sherlock Holmes, who's not a Superman, who's an incredibly gifted man, an incredibly talented man, and an incredibly driven man. But he's not an Ubermensch. He's somebody who exceeds in spite of the burdens he has and in spite of the things that have formed him, not because of them. And I kind of respect that too. It's something I can see paralleled in certain aspects of my own life. But Williamson is one of those actors who I've never seen him do work that I didn't like. And I think that he was another person who's been troubled by alcohol and a number of other things. But he was always a kind of, he had a streak of nastiness to him as a person. The Kenneth Tynan essay does demonstrate that. But it also demonstrates the incredible intelligence of the man and the fact that he was a jazz singer as well as an actor and other things. He was plagued by self-doubt in a lot of ways, which plays well into the way he plays Sherlock Holmes in The 7% Solution. I would have liked to have seen the West End Horror maybe done with Nicole Williamson, but he, because of his various problems, both mental and alcoholic, his career kind of diminished. But his Holmes is one of the memorable ones for me. It really is a strong piece of acting. It's one of the Sherlock Holmes that really humanizes the character. Sherlock Holmes can be seen in some senses, if it's handled badly, as a superhero kind of role. You've got that immense power of deduction, and Sherlock errs in this way in some ways. The BBC Sherlock with Benedict Cumberbatch does make him more than human, whereas The 7% Solution makes him very human and remarkable in spite of that. And I really like that. I have a great fondness for that. And I have a great fondness for Nicole Williamson as an actor. then there's another aspect of this film that I really like. I like, there are some action scenes in it that are pretty good. There's an attack by horses that are trained to kill, Lipizzaner horses, in which are trained in Austria, those great, big, beautiful white horses. There's a scene where Holmes, Watson, and Sigmund Freud are attacked by the Lipizzaner horses, which is kind of out, it came out unexpectedly, and there's a lot of fun. And before I talk about a couple of the other things, I really got to talk about Alan Arkin's having a, I keep saying Arkins, I'm not sure why, Alan Arkin having a lot of fun playing Sigmund Freud, who in his own way is as brilliant as Sherlock Holmes is. And like Nicole Williamson's Sherlock, shows a great humanity as well. The Sigmund Freud we see in this movie, who was in some ways very unlike the Sigmund Freud in real life, is a very human and compassionate person, and Alan Arkin plays that lovely. And I do like his character. In real life, of course, Sigmund Freud was a much more complex character with a much more complex personal life. He was also, even though he did know about cocaine addiction, he was not adverse to it. He thought that cocaine addiction, getting people onto cocaine would help them with an addiction to morphine, for instance. And he did that with a close friend of his who was addicted to morphine after an injury. And so he got him addicted to cocaine and just made the problem twice as bad. So you kind of got a, it's been a bit of a rewrite of the history of Sigmund Freud in there. But Arkin is really nice in that you've got the one of the villains, and there are a few villains in this one, but the main villain is played really nicely by Jeremy Kemp, an actor who was known for playing villainous roles. He plays Baron Karl von Lahnsdorf, and he does what's expected of it. I mean, it's, the villains aren't what this movie is about particularly. It's about the way Sherlock Holmes heals from an injury and how an explanation is given for aspects of his personal life that we didn't previously know about. But Jeremy Kemp's in there, and there's a really nice scene of Jeremy Kemp's Baron having a very unusual duel with Sigmund Freud, where Sigmund Freud outthinks him. And that's a nice one too. Played in a tennis court, which is actually a tennis court of the time, which has some very unusual aspects to it. There's also some more action scenes that are a lot of fun. There's an action scene, a train chase across Europe, which is kind of fun as well, where the Orient Express is being chased by a local train, which Sherlock Holmes, Dr. Watson, and Sigmund Freud hijack. And that, too, has a lot of fun to it, and that ends with a saber duel between the Baron and Sherlock Holmes on top of a train. And there's some really nice stunt work there. Some of the stunts were actually done by the actors. There are little bits of it where you can kind of just guess that it's a stuntman. But you do see a lot of, particularly Nicole Williamson and Jeremy Kemp, climbing around some fast-moving trains, which is kind of fun. I always like it when you can see the actors doing some of their own stunts, even though it may look a lot more dangerous than it actually was. But, Nicole Williamson's not an actor that is your automatic go-to for an action star. But he does comport himself very well in that and has some moments of fun too. And there is some humour in this movie as well. It's not an entirely serious film. There's a scene where there's a Weasley little character who is, they've got to get some evidence from, played by Joel Grey, who we know from Cabaret and the father of Jennifer Grey, father-in-law of Clark Gregg, who plays this wheezy little character in a bowler hat and a long overcoat, who leads them into a brothel. And it's like a turn-of-the-century Viennese brothel, and it's lovely. All the prostitutes are beautiful. And they've got a song being sung by the madam of the brothel, played by a cabaret star called Regine. And the song was written for the movie by none other than Stephen Sondheim. And it's one of the most delightfully filthy songs that I know. And I'm going to play it at the end of this episode. I'm going to play a version of the song sung by Petula Clark. But you've got to listen to the lyrics very carefully because it's utterly filthy in a very delightful way and in a way that is of its time. Now, the song's called I Never Do Anything Twice, which is kind of funny because one of the things that Stephen Sondheim's lyrics are known for is they don't really repeat, apart from maybe the title of the song. So I'm going to play I Never Do Anything Twice, which is one of my favourite Sondheim songs, and comes from this movie. And it's just thrown in there as a little bit of a kind of a scene setting for the movie, and also to give a break from the headlong chase at that time. Having that little scene in there in the brothel where Holmes and Watson and Sigmund Freud realise they're in a brothel. The interesting thing to watch in that scene, if you rewatch it, is Robert Duvall's reaction to various things as Dr. Watson. Now, Dr. Watson was known as a ladies' man before his marriage, and he's got a certain sly smile on his face about being in a Viennese brothel, which is kind of amusing and nice piece of work by Robert Duvall. So all credit to Robert Duvall for that. But just to wrap this up, 7% Solution, I like it as the Sherlock Holmes movie. I think that it's probably among one of my five or six favourite Sherlock Holmes movies. I like The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes as well. I don't mind the Robert Downey Jr. ones. They're a bit retrofitted and they're a bit modern. But I don't mind them at all. I think they're a lot of fun to have. And ultimately, when it comes down to it, that's what Sherlock Holmes is about in all of his iterations, from The Strand magazine to Benedict Cumberbatch. They're about having a bit of fun and going along for the ride. And these two movies, The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes and The 7% Solution, definitely do that. They're a lot of fun. They were a lot of fun for me to revisit, and they're a lot of fun as films as well. So I'm going to wrap up there, and after the credits, I'm going to play, the credits, and you get a credit on this podcast by being one of our Patreon subscribers at patreon.com/paleocinema. I'm not going to oversell that, but if you'd like to support the podcast with a dollar or so a month, I'd be very happy to accept it, and you will get a credit in the style of a movie credit. So just to finalize it all, I'm going to get a few more podcasts under my belt before I go on holidays. But in the meantime, everybody enjoy yourselves. Watch good films. Take care of each other. Enjoy your life. Live well. And I will be back very soon with another podcast. So we'll get the credits done now, and then we will have Petula Clark singing I Never Do Anything Twice. And here are the podcast credits in the style of movie credits. And the way to get on the credits is to donate to the podcast via patreon.com/paleocinema. Okay, we have Tim the Mystery Credit. I haven't got the credit from Tim yet. We have Tammy the Donut Wrangler. Paul the Special Makeup Effects Director. Mark the Second Unit Director. Alyssa the Location Scout. Tansy the Foley Artist. Miss Jane, the Wardrobe Mistress. Christopher, the Gaffer. Chris, the Camera Operator. And we'll wait for the big crescendo in the music, which is Alberato del Gracioso by Ravel. Julia, the Casting Director. Elaine, the Scientific Advisor. Matt, the Rattlesnake Wrangler. Armin, the key grip, Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the music director, Gary, the prop master, Claire, the script doctor, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Ian, the caterer, Sarah, the special effects technician, and Tom, the focus puller. Thank you very much to all of the people who support the podcast via the Patreon campaign. I'll catch you guys later.
I don't recall the date. I met a handsome captain of the guard. He visited my chambers one evening rather late, in tandem with a husky Saint Bernard. At first I was astonished, and tears came to my eyes, but later, when I asked him to resume, he said, to my surprise, "My dear, it isn't wise. When love is concerned, one must freshen the bloom. Once, yes, once for a lark. Twice, though, loses the spark. One must never deny it, but after you try it, you vary the diet. Said my handsome young god, yes, I know that it's hard. I think about the baron who came at my command and proffered me a riding crop and chains. The evening that we shared was meticulously planned. He took the most extraordinary pains. He trembled with excitement, his cheeks were quite aglow. And afterward he cried to me, "Encore!" He pleaded with me so to have another go. I murmured caressingly, "Whatever for?" Once, yes, once for a lark. Twice, thou loses the spark. Once, yes, is delicious, but twice would be vicious, or just repetitious. Someone's bound to be scarred. Yes, I know that it's hard, but no matter the price, I never do anything twice. La 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 la. Shipped at my feet, who dressed me in a wimple and in veils. He made a proposition which I found rather sweet, and handed me a hammer and some nails. In time we lay contented, and he began again by fingering the beads around our waists. I whispered to him then, "We'll have to say amen." For a lark, twice though loses the spark. As I said to the abbot, I'll get in the habit, but not in the habit. You've my highest regard, and I know that it's hard. Still, no matter the price, I'll never do it. I never do anything twice.